In the brainstem, a narrow area that controls breathing, and that she had between 3 and 9 months to live. Nicole's parents immediately took her to the hospital at the University of California at San Francisco. That evening, the head of neurosurgery told her that her only hope of staying alive was massive doses of radiation. A surgeon's knife in that small area would kill her. On the morning of January 21st, she got her first dose of radiation and then, over the next 6 weeks, received the maximum amount a human being can tolerate, so much that she can never have radiation again. She also was given high doses of steroids to reduce swelling in her brainstem, which can also be fatal. The radiation saved her life, but was the beginning of new woes. About 2 or 3 weeks into the radiation, Nicole says, I started having tingling in my right foot. With time, it climbed up the right side of my body, up to my knee, hips, torso, and arms, and then my face. She was soon paralyzed and without sensation on her whole right side. She is right-handed, so the loss of that hand was critical. It got so bad, she says, I couldn't sit up or even turn in bed. It was like when your leg falls asleep and you can't stand up on it and it collapses. The doctors soon determined that it was not a stroke, but a rare and severe side effect of the radiation that had damaged her brain. One of life's little ironies, she says. From the hospital, she was taken to her parents' home. I had to be pushed in a wheelchair, pulled out of bed, and carried and helped into or out of a chair. She was able to eat with her left hand, but only after her parents tied her into a chair with a sheet to prevent her from falling, especially dangerous because she couldn't reach out to break a fall with her arms. With continued immobility and doses of steroids, she went from 125 pounds to 190 and developed what she calls a pumpkin face. The radiation also made patches of her hair fall out. She was psychologically devastated and especially upset by the grief her illness was causing others. For 6 months, Nicole became so depressed that she stopped speaking or even sitting up in bed. I remember this period, but I don't understand it. I remember watching the clock, waiting for time to go by or getting up for my meals as my parents were adamant that I got up for 3 meals a day. Her parents had been in the Peace Corps and had a can-do attitude. Her father, a general practitioner, quit his medical practice and stayed home to nurse her despite her protests. They took her to movies or out along the ocean in her wheelchair to keep her connected to life. They told me I'd get through it, she said, to ride the ride and this would pass. Meanwhile, friends and family sought information about possible treatments. One of them told Nicole about the Taub Clinic, and she decided to undergo CI therapy. There she was given a mitt to wear so she wouldn't be able to use her left hand. She found the staff unyielding on this point. She laughs and says, they did a funny thing the first night. When the phone rang at the hotel where she was staying with her mother, Nicole threw off her mitt and picked up after one ring. I instantly got scolded by my therapist. She was checking on me and knew that if I picked up on one ring, I was obviously not using my affected arm. I was instantly busted. Not only did she have a mitt. Because I talk with my hands and I'm a storyteller, they had to strap my mitt to my leg with a Velcro strip, which I found very funny. You definitely lower your pride on that one. We were each assigned one therapist. I was assigned Christine. There was an instant connection. Mitt on her good hand, Nicole soon was trying to write on a whiteboard or type on a keyboard with her paralyzed hand. One exercise began by putting poker chips into a large oatmeal can. By the end of the week, she was putting the chips into a small slit in a tennis ball can. Again and again, she stacked rainbow-colored baby rings on a rod, clipped clothespins to a yardstick, or tried to stick a fork into Play-Doh and bring it to her mouth. At first, the staff helped her. Then she did the exercises while Christine timed her with a stopwatch. Each time Nicole completed a task and said, that was the best I could do, Christine would say, no, it's not. Nicole says, it's really incredible the amount of improvement that occurred in just 5 minutes. And then over 2 weeks, it's earth-shattering. They do not allow you to say the word can't, which Christine called the four-letter word. Buttoning was insanely frustrating for me. Just one button seemed like an impossible task. I had rationalized that I could get through life without ever doing that again. And what you learn at the end of the 2 weeks, as you are buttoning and unbuttoning a lab coat rapidly, is that your whole mindset can shift about what you are able to do. One night, in the middle of the 2-week course of therapy, all the patients went out for dinner in a restaurant. We definitely made a mess at the table. The waiters had seen Taub Clinic patients before, and they knew what to expect. Food was flying, with us all trying to eat with our affected arms. There were 16 of us. It was pretty funny. By the end of the 2nd week, I was actually making the pot of coffee with my affected arm. If I wanted coffee, they said, guess what? You get to make it. I had to scoop it out and put it in the machine and fill it with water. The whole thing with my affected arm. I don't know how drinkable it was. I asked her how she felt when she was leaving. Completely rejuvenated, even more mentally than physically. It gave me the will to improve and have normalcy in my life. She hadn't hugged anyone with her affected arm for 3 years, but now she could do so again. I am now known for having a wimpy handshake, but I do it. I'm not throwing a javelin with the arm, but I can open up the refrigerator door, turn off a light or a faucet, and put shampoo on my head. These little improvements allow her to live alone and drive to work on the freeway with 2 hands on the wheel. She's started swimming, and the week before she and I spoke, she'd gone parallel skiing without poles in Utah. Throughout her ordeal, her bosses and co-workers at both CNN and Entertainment Tonight followed her progress and helped financially. When a freelance job in entertainment at CNN New York came up, she took it. By September, she was working full-time again. On September 11, 2001, she was at her desk looking out the window and saw the 2nd plane hit the World Trade Center. In the crisis, she was assigned to the newsroom and to stories that, under other circumstances, might have been simplified out of sensitivity to her special needs. But they weren't. The attitude was, you've got a good mind, use it. This, she says, was probably the best thing for me. When that job came to an end, Nicole returned to California and to teaching elementary school. The children embraced her immediately. They even had a Miss Nicole von Rudin Day when the children got out of their school buses wearing cooking mitts, like those at the Taub Clinic, and kept them on all day. They joked about her writing and her weak right hand, so she had them write with their weaker or less dominant hands. And, says Nicole, they weren't allowed to use the word can't. I actually had little therapists. My 1st graders had me raise my hand over my head while they counted. Every day I had to hold it up longer. They were tough. Nicole is now working full-time as a producer for Entertainment Tonight. Her job includes script writing, fact-checking, and coordinating shoots. She was in charge of the Michael Jackson trial coverage. The woman who couldn't roll herself over in bed now gets to work at 5 a.m. and works a 50-hour-plus week. She's back to her old weight of 126 pounds. She still has some residual tingling and weakness on her right side, but she can carry things in her right hand, raise it, get dressed, and take care of herself in general. And she has returned to helping kids who have AIDS. The principles of constraint-induced therapy have been applied by a team headed by Dr. Friedemann Pulvermüller in Germany, which worked with Taub to help stroke patients who have damage to Broca's area and have lost the ability to speak. About 40% of patients who have a left hemisphere stroke have this speech aphasia. Some, like Broca's famous aphasia patient, Tan, can use only one word. Others have more words but are still severely limited. Some do get better spontaneously or get some words back, but it has generally been thought that those who didn't improve within a year couldn't. What is the equivalent of putting a mitt on the mouth or a sling on speech? Patients with aphasia, like those with arm paralysis, tend to fall back on the equivalent of their good arm. They use gestures or draw pictures. If they can speak at all, they tend to say what is easiest over and over. The constraint imposed on aphasiacs is not physical, but it's just as real. A series of language rules. Since behavior must be shaped, these rules are introduced slowly. Patients play a therapeutic card game. Four people play with 32 cards made up of 16 different pictures, two of each picture. A patient with a card with a rock on it must ask the others for the same picture. At first, the only requirement is that they not point to the card so as not to reinforce learned non-use. They are allowed to use any kind of circumlocution as long as it is verbal. If they want a card with a picture of the sun and can't find the word, they are permitted to say, "the thing that makes you hot in the day," to get the card they want. Once they get two of a kind, they can discard them. The winner is the player who gets rid of his cards first. The next stage is to name the object correctly. Now they must ask a precise question, such as, "Can I have the dog card?" Next, they must add the person's name and a polite remark. "Mr. Schmidt, may I please have a copy of the sun card?" Later in the training, more complex cards are used. Colors and numbers are introduced. A card with three blue socks and two rocks, for instance. At the beginning, patients are praised for accomplishing simple tasks. As they progress, only four more difficult ones. The German team took on a very challenging population. Patients who had had their strokes on average 8.3 years before, the very ones whom most had given up on. They studied 17 patients. Seven in a control group got conventional treatment, simply repeating words. The other 10 got CI therapy for language and had to obey the rules of the language game 3 hours a day for 10 days. Both groups spent the same number of hours, then were given standard language tests. In the 10 days of treatment, after only 32 hours, the CI therapy group had a 30% increase in communication. The conventional treatment group had none. Based on his work with plasticity, Taub has discovered a number of training principles. Training is more effective if the skill closely relates to everyday life. Training should be done in increments, and work should be concentrated into a short time, a training technique Taub calls massed practice, which he has found far more effective than long-term but less frequent training. Many of these same principles are used in immersion learning of a foreign language. How many of us have taken language courses over years and not learned as much as when we went to the country and immersed ourselves in the language for a far shorter period? Our time spent with people who don't speak our native tongue, forcing us to speak theirs, is the constraint. Daily immersion allows us to get massed practice. Our accent suggests to others that they may have to use simpler language with us. Hence, we are incrementally challenged or shaped. Learned non-use is thwarted because our survival depends on communication. Taub has applied CI principles to a number of other disorders. He has begun working with children with cerebral palsy, a complex, tragic disability that can be brought on by damage in the developing brain caused by stroke, infection, lack of oxygen during birth, and other problems. These children often cannot walk and are confined to wheelchairs for life, cannot speak clearly or control their movements, and have impaired or paralyzed arms. Before CI therapy, treatment of paralyzed arms in these children was generally considered ineffective. Taub did a study in which half the children got conventional cerebral palsy rehab and half got CI therapy, with their better functioning arm placed in a light fiberglass cast. The CI therapy included popping soap bubbles with their affected fingers, pounding balls into a hole, and picking up puzzle pieces. Each time the children succeeded, they were heaped with praise and then, in the next game, encouraged to improve accuracy, speed, and fluidity of motion, even if they were very tired. The children showed extraordinary gains in a 3-week training period. Some began to crawl for the first time. An 18-month-old was able to crawl up steps and use his hand to put food in his mouth for the first time. One 4.5-year-old boy, who had never used his arm or hand, began to play ball. And then there was Frederick Lincoln. Frederick had a massive stroke when he was in his mother's womb. When he was 4.5 months old, it became clear to his mother that something was not right. "I noticed he wasn't doing what other boys in daycare were doing. They could sit up and hold their bottle, and my child could not. I knew something was wrong, but didn't know where to turn. The entire left side of his body was affected. His arm and leg didn't function well. His eye drooped, and he couldn't form sounds or words because his tongue was partially paralyzed. Frederick couldn't crawl or walk when other children did. He couldn't talk until he was 3. When Frederick was 7 months old, he had a seizure, and his left arm was drawn up to his chest and couldn't be pulled away. He was given an MRI brain scan that, the doctor told his mother, showed that 1/4 of his brain was dead, and that he would probably never crawl, walk, or talk. The doctor believed the stroke had occurred about 12 weeks after Frederick was conceived. He was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, with paralysis on the left side of his body. His mother, who worked in the federal district court, quit her job to devote all her time to Frederick, causing a major financial strain on the family. Frederick's disability also affected his 8.5-year-old sister. "I had to explain to his sister," his mother says, "that her new brother would not be able to take care of himself and that Mama would have to do it and that we didn't know how long that would last. We didn't even know if Frederick would ever be able to do things by himself." When Frederick was 18 months old, his mother heard about the Taub Clinic for adults and asked if Frederick could be treated. But it would be several years before the clinic developed a program for children. By the time he went to Taub's clinic, Frederick was 4. He had made some progress using conventional approaches. He could walk with a leg brace and could talk with difficulty, but his progress had plateaued. He could use his left arm, but not his left hand. Because he had no pincer grasp and couldn't touch his thumb to any of his fingers, he couldn't pick up a ball and hold it in his palm. He had to use the palm of his right hand and the back of his left. At first, Frederick didn't want to participate in the Taub treatment and rebelled, eating his mashed potatoes with the hand that had a cast on it instead of trying to use his affected one. To make sure that Frederick got 21 uninterrupted days of treatment, the CI therapy was not done at the Taub Clinic. "At our convenience," says his mother, "it was done at daycare, home, church, grandma's, anywhere we were. The therapist rode to church with us, and while she did, she worked on his hand in the car. Then she'd go to Sunday school class with him. She worked around our plans. The majority of Monday through Friday was spent in Frederick's daycare, though. He knew we were trying to make Lefty better, because that is what we call it." A mere 19 days into the therapy, Lefty developed a pincer grasp. "Now," says his mother, "he can do anything with that left hand, but it is weaker than the right. He can open a Ziploc bag, and he can hold a baseball bat. He continues to improve every day. His motor skills are dramatically improved." That improvement started during the project with Taub, and has continued ever since. "I can't think of anything I do for him other than being a typical parent as far as assisting him goes." Because Frederick became more independent, his mother was able to go back to work. Frederick is now 8, and he doesn't think of himself as disabled. He can run, he plays a number of sports, including volleyball, but he has always loved baseball best. So that he can keep his glove on, his mother sewed Velcro inside it, which fastens to the Velcro on a small brace he wears on his arm. Frederick's progress has been phenomenal. He tried out for the regular baseball team, not one for handicapped children, and made the cut. "He played so well on the team," says his mother, "that he was chosen by the coaches for the All-Star team. I cried for 2 hours when they told me that." Frederick is right-handed and holds the bat normally. Occasionally he loses his left-hand grip, but his right hand is now so strong that he can swing one-handed. In 2002, she says, he played in the 5- to 6-year-old division baseball, and he played in 5 All-Star games. He had the winning play in 3 of the 5 games. He won the championship with his winning RBI. "It was awesome. I've got it on video." The tale of the Silver Spring monkeys and neuroplasticity was not yet finished. Years had passed since the monkeys were removed from Taub's lab. But in the meantime, neuroscientists had begun to appreciate what Taub, so often ahead of his time, had been discovering. This new interest in Taub's work, and in the monkeys themselves, will lead to one of the single most important plasticity experiments ever performed. Mrzenek, in his experiments, showed that when sensory input from a finger was cut off, brain map changes typically occurred in 1 to 2 millimeters of the cortex. Scientists thought that the probable explanation for this amount of plastic change was the growth of individual neuronal branches. Brain neurons, when damaged, might send out small sprouts or branches to connect to other neurons. If one neuron died or lost input, the branches of an adjacent neuron had the ability to grow 1 to 2 millimeters to compensate. But if this was the mechanism by which plastic change occurred, then change was limited to the few neurons close to the damage. There could be plastic change between nearby sectors of the brain, but not between sectors that lay farther apart. Mrzenek's colleague at Vanderbilt, John Koss, worked with a student named Tim Pons, who was troubled by the 1 to 2 millimeter limit. Was that really the upper limit of plastic change? Or did Mrzenek observe that amount of change because of his technique, which in some key experiments involved cutting only a single nerve? Pons wondered what would happen in the brain if all the nerves in the hand were cut. Would more than 2 millimeters be affected? And would changes be seen between sectors? The animals that could answer the question were the Silver Spring monkeys, because they alone had spent 12 years without sensory input to their brain maps. Ironically, PETA's interference for so many years had made them increasingly valuable to the scientific community. If any creature had massive cortical reorganization that could be mapped, it would be one of them. But it wasn't clear who owned the animals, though they were in NIH custody. The agency at times insisted it didn't own them. They were hot potatoes, and didn't dare experiment with them because they were the focus of PETA's campaign to have them released. By now, however, the serious scientific community, including NIH, was growing fed up with witch hunts. In 1987, PETA brought a custody case to the Supreme Court, but the court declined to hear it. As the monkeys aged, their health deteriorated, and one of them, Paul, lost a lot of weight. PETA began lobbying NIH to have him euthanized, a mercy killing, and sought a court order to bring it about. By December 1989, another monkey, Billy, was also suffering and dying. Mortimer Mishkin, head of the Society for Neuroscience and chief of the Laboratory of Neuropsychology at the NIH's Institute of Mental Health, had many years before inspected Taub's first deafferentation experiment that had overturned Sherrington's reflexological theory. Mishkin had stood up for Taub during the Silver Spring monkey affair, and was one of the very few who had opposed ending Taub's NIH grant. Mishkin met with Pons and agreed that when the monkeys were to be euthanized, a final experiment could be done. It was a brave decision, since Congress had gone on record as favoring PETA. The scientists were well aware that PETA might go berserk, so they left the government out of it and arranged to have the experiment funded privately. In the experiment, the monkey Billy was to be anesthetized, and a microelectrode analysis of the brain map for his arm was to be done just before he was euthanized. Because there was so much pressure on the scientists and surgeons, they did in 4 hours what normally would have taken more than a day. They removed part of the monkey's skull, inserted electrodes into 124 different spots in the sensory cortex area for the arm, and stroked the deafferented arm. As expected, the arm sent no electrical impulses to the electrodes. Then, Pons stroked the monkey's face, knowing that the brain map for the face is adjacent to the map for the arm. To his amazement, as he touched the face, the neurons in the monkey's deafferented arm map also began to fire, confirming that the facial map had taken over the arm map. As Mrzenek had seen in his own experiments, when a brain map is not used, the brain can reorganize itself so that another mental function takes over that processing space. Most surprising was the scope of the reorganization. 14 millimeters, or over half an inch of the arm map, had rewired itself to process facial sensory input, the largest amount of rewiring that had ever been mapped. Billy was given a lethal injection. 6 months later, the experiment was repeated on three other monkeys with the same results. The experiment gave a tremendous boost to Taub, a co-author of the paper that followed, and to other neuroplasticians who were hoping to rewire the brains of people who had large amounts of brain damage. Not only could the brain respond to damage by having single neurons grow new branches within their own small sectors, but, the experiment showed, reorganization could occur across very large sectors. Like many neuroplasticians, Taub has his hand in numerous collaborative experiments. He has a computer version of CI therapy for people who cannot come to the clinic called AutoSight, Automated CI Therapy, that is showing promising results. CI therapy is now being assessed in national trials throughout the United States. Taub is also on a team developing a machine to help people who are totally paralyzed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, the illness Stephen Hawking has. The machine would transmit their thoughts through brain waves that direct a computer cursor to select letters and spell words to form short sentences. He is involved in a cure for tinnitus, or ringing in the ears, that can be caused by plastic changes in the auditory cortex. Taub also wants to find out whether stroke patients can develop completely normal movements with CI therapy. Patients now receive treatment for only 2 weeks. He wants to know what would happen with a year of the therapy. But perhaps his greatest contribution is that his approach to brain damage and problems in the nervous system applies to so many conditions. Even a non-neurological disease like arthritis may lead to learned non-use, because after an attack, patients often stop using the limb or joint. CI therapy might help them get their movement back. In all of medicine, few conditions are as terrifying as a stroke, when a part of our brain dies. But Taub has shown that even in this state, as long as there is adjacent living tissue, because that tissue is plastic, there may be hope that it might take over. Few scientists have gathered so much immediately practical knowledge from their experimental animals. Ironically, the only episode of pointless physical distress to animals in the entire Silver Spring affair occurred when, while in PETA's hands, they suspiciously disappeared. For that was when they appear to have been taken on a 2,000-mile round trip to Florida and back, which left them so physically disturbed and agitated. Edward Taub's work daily transforms people, most of whom were struck down in the midnight of their lives. Each time they learn to move their paralyzed bodies and speak, they resurrect not only themselves, but the brilliant career of Edward Taub. Chapter 6. Brain Lock Unlocked. Using plasticity to stop worries, obsessions, compulsions, and bad habits. All of us have worries. We worry because we are intelligent beings. Intelligence predicts. That is its essence, the same intelligence that allows us to plan, hope, imagine, and hypothesize, also allows us to worry and anticipate negative outcomes. But there are people who are great worriers, whose worrying is in a class of its own. Their suffering, though, all in the head, goes far beyond what most people experience precisely because it is all in the head and is thus inescapable. Such people are so constantly traumatized by their own brains that they often consider suicide. In one case, a desperate college student felt so trapped by his obsessive worries and compulsions that he put a gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. The bullet passed into his frontal lobe, causing a frontal lobotomy, which was at the time a treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder. He was found still alive, his disorder cured, and he returned to college. There are many kinds of worriers and many types of anxiety, phobias, post-traumatic stress disorders, and panic attacks. But among the people who suffer most are those with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, who are terrified that some harm will come or has come to them or to those they love. Though they may have been fairly anxious as children, at some later point, often as young adults, they have an attack that takes their worrying to a new level. Once self-possessed adults, they now feel like anguished, terrified children. Ashamed that they've lost control, they often hide their worry from others, sometimes for years before they seek help. In the worst cases, they cannot awaken from these nightmares for months at a time or even years. Medications may quell their anxieties, but often don't eliminate the problem. OCD often worsens over time, gradually altering the structure of the brain. A patient with OCD may try to get relief by focusing on his worry, making sure he's covered all the bases and left nothing to chance. But the more he thinks about his fear, however, the more he worries about it, because with OCD, worry begets worry. There is often an emotional trigger for the first major attack. A person might remember that it is the anniversary of his mother's death, hear about a rival's car accident, feel an ache or lump in his body, read about a chemical in the food supply, or see an image of burned hands in a film. Then he begins to worry that he is approaching the age that his mother was when she died and, though not generally superstitious, now feels he is doomed to die that day, or that his rival's early death awaits him too, or that he has discovered the first symptoms of an untreatable disease, or that he has already been poisoned because he was not vigilant enough about what he ate. We all experience such thoughts fleetingly, but people with OCD lock onto the worry and can't let it go. Their brains and minds march them through various dread scenarios, and though they try to resist thinking about them, they cannot. The threats feel so real, they think they must attend to them. Typical obsessions are fears of contracting a terminal illness, being contaminated by germs, being poisoned by chemicals, being threatened by electromagnetic radiation, or even being betrayed by one's own genes. Sometimes obsessionals get preoccupied with symmetry. They are bothered when pictures are not perfectly level, or their teeth are not perfectly straight, or when objects are not kept in perfect order, and they can spend hours lining them up properly. Or they become superstitious about certain numbers and can set an alarm clock or volume control only on an even number. Sexual or aggressive thoughts, a fear they have hurt loved ones, might intrude into their minds, but where these thoughts come from, they do not know. A typical obsessional thought might be, "The thud that I heard while driving means I may have run somebody over." If they are religious, blasphemous thoughts might arise, causing guilt and worry. Many people with OCD have obsessive doubts and are always second-guessing themselves. Have they turned off the stove, locked the door, or hurt someone's feelings inadvertently? The worries can be bizarre and make no conceivable sense even to the worrier, but that doesn't make them any less tormenting. A loving mother and wife worries, "I am going to harm my baby," or "I will get up in my sleep and stab my husband with a butcher knife in the chest while he's sleeping." A husband has the obsessive thought that there are razor blades attached to his fingernails, so he cannot touch his children or make love to his wife or pat his dog. His eyes see no blades, but his mind insists they are there, and he keeps asking his wife for reassurance that he hasn't hurt her. Often obsessives fear the future because of some mistake they may have made in the past, but it is not only the mistakes that have happened that haunt them, mistakes that they imagine they could make. Should they let their guard down for a moment, which they, being human, eventually will, also generate a sense of dread that cannot be turned off. The agony of the obsessive worrier is that whenever something bad is remotely possible, it feels inevitable. I have had several patients whose worries about their health were so intense that they felt as though they were on death row, each day awaiting their execution. But their drama does not end there. Even if they are told their health is fine, they may feel only the briefest flash of relief before they harshly diagnose themselves as crazy for all they have put themselves through, though often this insight is obsessional second-guessing in a new guise. Soon after obsessive worries begin, OCD patients typically do something to diminish the worry, a compulsive act. If they feel they have been contaminated by germs, they wash themselves. When that doesn't make the worry go away, they wash all their clothing, the floors, and then the walls. If a woman fears she will kill her baby, she wraps the butcher knife in cloth, packs it in a box, locks it in the basement, then locks the door to the basement. The UCLA psychiatrist Jeffrey M. Schwartz describes a man who feared being contaminated by the battery acid spilled in car accidents. Each night he lay in bed listening for sirens that would signal an accident nearby. When he heard them, he would get up, no matter what the hour, put on special running shoes, and drive until he found the site. After the police left, he would scrub the asphalt with a brush for hours, then skulk home and throw out the shoes he had worn. Obsessive doubters often develop checking compulsions. If they doubt they've turned off the stove or locked the door, they go back to check and recheck, often 100 or more times. Because the doubt never goes away, it might take them hours to leave the house. People who fear that a thud they heard while driving might mean they ran someone over will drive around the block just to make sure there is no corpse in the road. If their obsessional fear is of a dread disease, they will scan and re-scan their body for symptoms or make dozens of visits to the doctor. After a while, these checking compulsions are ritualized. If they feel they have been dirtied, they must clean themselves in a precise order, putting on gloves to turn on the tap and scrubbing their bodies in a particular sequence. If they have blasphemous or sexual thoughts, they may invent a ritual way of praying a certain number of times. These rituals are probably related to the magical and superstitious beliefs most obsessionals have.
This is the end of disc number 5. Please insert disc number 6.